I would like to give thanks to the ancestors, known and unknown, those who have paved the way for us to survive this moment of time and to have a reference point to use as a blueprint to deal with these hellish times we are living in. I would also like to give honor and reverence to the woman of the universe for your superior work, for bringing forth the spiritual information through the triple stage of darkness of your womb and giving birth to God. We would like to give reverence to the universe and praises to the indigenous. My name is Raheem Shabazz, and this is Necessary Blackness Podcast.
Necessary Blackness Podcast, every Wednesday at 6 p.m. with award-winning journalist and filmmaker Raheem Shabazz. This podcast is only for those who are unapologetic, because the mind of the conscious man or woman recognize no monopoly on truth. Truth is relative and always to be sought.
Hey, Atlanta, have you heard? True Laundry Detergent is now offering free shipping in the Atlanta area. Just text the word TRUE to 404-493-0523 or give us a call. That's 404-493-0523. True Detergent is 4 times concentrated and perfect for those HE washers. Just 1 ounce removes dirt, brightens fabrics, and leaves each load with a clean, fresh scent. Best of all, True contains no animal products and it's safe for sensitive skin. Follow us on social media, True Detergent ATL.
Award-winning producer Raheem Shabazz continues the Elementary Genocide documentary series with The School to Prison Pipeline. That film exposes the social engineering done to African-American children in the school system. And his other film, Elementary Genocide 2, The Board of Education versus the Board of Incarceration, takes an even deeper look at the history of the American school system and how it was made to justify subjugating Black Americans. These films are on track to be the most discussed films in Black America. These films feature people like Dr. Boyce Watkins, Dr. Francis Kretz Welsing, and many, many more. The documentary is available right now at elementarygenocide.com. That's elementarygenocide.com.
The creators of Elementary Genocide Part 1, The School to Prison Pipeline, and Part 2, The Board of Education versus the Board of Incarceration, present the third installment, Academic Holocaust. Each film produced, directed, and personally funded by writer Raheem Shabazz. Hollywood Chronicles says the documentary Elementary Genocide turns a critical eye towards the dehumanizing educational environment that criminalizes Black and brown youth by funneling them from schools to prisons. As the third installment to the critically acclaimed series nears completion, we're looking to our legion of supporters to help us reach the finish line by making a donation today. If you've learned anything, shared any content, or have received any value from the Elementary Genocide brand, you're going to love Elementary Genocide 3, featuring the likes of Kaba Kemi, David Banner, Shahrazad Ali, Michael Imhotep, and Professor James Small. To help spread this important message to the masses, visit elementarygenocide.com or search Elementary Genocide 3 on indiegogo.com and make your contribution today. That's elementarygenocide.com or indiegogo.com. If you're unable to donate, please share our cause with your family and friends.
Peace and power, Black family. This is your host, Raheem Shabazz, and this is episode 17 of Necessary Blackness Podcast. Today, we're going to chop it up with Daruba Banwardhard. Daruba is an activist, former prisoner, Black Panther Party leader, and co-founder of the Black Liberation Army. Daruba in Swahili means the storm. Ladies and gentlemen, get ready for Daruba. The brother is highly intellectual, well-read, and he always brings the truth and he makes you think. And without further ado, I'm going to get Daruba on the line and we're going to chop it up. And it's always a monumental moment when I get down and be able to kick it with the OG.
You'll hear it here first.
And now our feature presentation.
All right, tell us about the white right-wing agenda of the present administration and what Black America got to do to counter the attack.
I mean, there's a whole multiplicity of dimensions to and consequences to the present political order. And I think that we're not very much prepared. We're ill-prepared in terms of our community organization, type of political leadership that our community really requires right now, the type of stand-up leadership. We're really not at an advantageous position. After 8 years of Obama and the type of move to the right that he has permitted during his 8 years, type of policies that he carried out. You know, it was his administration that handed the empire to the Trump cabal. So it's very hard to talk about how the right-wing power in this country, how wealth has consolidated and controlled the two-party system, the electoral system here in the United States. And this rise of right-wing anti-race, this rise of right-wing racism, anti-immigration sentiments, the so-called popularism of the white working class is occurring across the whole entire spectrum of the Western industrialized world. And so we need to understand that what we're experiencing in terms of policing in the United States, what we're experiencing in terms of white supremacy, the rise of white supremacy, consolidation of wealth and political power, you know, represents a crisis in the economic system that the people with property and wealth are intent on managing. And that management requires that they control population, that people function based on fear, and fear of each other, fear of the unknown, fear of terrorism, fear of crime, fear of drug addiction. We have a society that's functioning and propositioned on fear. And the saviors that stand between our fears and their realization are the police and state security apparatus that constantly tells us that we need them to protect us. So we have painted ourselves into a corner here. We don't have the type of economic power and control of our economies that are needed to exercise some type of independent political insurgency on our part to maintain that, to put that forward, to represent our interests. At the same time, we don't have the type of people in positions of influence and control and elected offices that really have the strong backbone, that really have an analysis of our situation and who are genuine abolitionists rather than reformists of white supremacy. I think so. We're in bad shape. And I think that in the next year or so, the United States will involve itself more heavily in wars abroad and foreign wars and more heavily in terms of militarized policing. So we're headed for a really grim period of fascism and political repression.
You mentioned 8 years of Obama and his running of the empire. Some might argue that Obama was the best thing to happen to Black America. What would you say in defense of that?
Well, I wouldn't defend that. I think Obama's record speaks for itself. He came in talking about ending the U.S. War in Iraq, and instead he wound up expanding. He said that he would bring the troops home from Iraq. He managed a rise called a surge in Iraq that resulted in the formation of an Iraqi a resistance movement that morphed into ISIL. Islamic Republic. And he has carried out more drone attacks, over 500 and something drone attacks in office, than any other president before him. And he has killed more people on designated assassination list that he used to supervise every morning than any other president. And he's oversaw the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi and the Libyan government for finance capital purposes, for the purposes of securing the U.S. currency and oil. We saw him. He's also signed the largest arms deal in U.S. history with the racist apartheid government of Israel, and basically gave them a carte blanche in terms of military aid and economic assistance to this racist settler state. And so I don't know how we can say that Obama has done anything for Black folks, because he hardly spoke about Black people or their plight or their situation. He presided over a system of mass incarceration of over 2.5 million prisoners. It's true that as a federal official, he wasn't responsible for state incarceration, but nonetheless, Justice Department under Obama has did nothing to rein in the police terrorism and murder and assassination of black folks was going on for 8 years under his administration. He hardly spoke on it, except on a few occasions. So I don't understand why we could say that he has been beneficial to Africans in the United States. Now, on the other hand, in terms of finance capital in the military, he has been one of the greatest presidents ever. A lot of folks fail to realize that a lot of things that Trump is doing in terms of expanding immigration prisons and strengthening the hiring more border police and more federal agents. Obama did that for all 8 years of his presidency. You know, he deported more people. He was known as the deporter in general. You know, he deported more people than any other president, you know. So we need to really understand that a lot of the things that Obama got away with, you know, was due to the fact that you had a black comprador class, you still do. You have a black political elite class that looked at Obama as a triumph for the slave mentality, you know. So I don't think that we could really look at the Obama administration as an administration that worked really on behalf of African people, as opposed to on behalf of administering the empire and the military-industrial complex.
What is the best way to challenge the political power of the police since we're living in a police state?
Well, first of all, I think that we need to understand that the way the police demilitarize policing that we are witnessing in our communities, the criminalization of generations of young black males and women, the marginalization of people, groups, and minorities, and their criminalization, Islamophobia, all of these aspects that have heavily influenced our policing as presently constituted. So the only way that we could really deal with the situation of police accountability, reducing police brutality and police murder and intimidation of people of color, is to control the police forces that police our communities. And that means we have to abolish our policing as it's presently constituted, as it's presently constructed, as it's presently organized. And we have to establish a decentralized policing system, a system of community control policing, whether it's based on electoral districting lines or based on other demographic lines that have been recognized, zones or whatever. We need to have people controlling the armed agents of the state in their community. And this also may require retraining of first responders to emergencies. This also may require residency clauses for police in urban areas, in minority communities. There may be property should be set aside and developed so that the police can live in the communities that they police rather than outside of those communities. And we have to create mechanisms that move criminal justice or criminal enforcement away from the current paradigm of punishment to one of restorative justice, where the community is involved in restoring the individuals who are convicted of criminal offenses in the community. There's a whole panacea, a panoply of measures that we should be advocating. But the foremost one is to take community control of police. We have to have that. We have to have a decentralized policing. We have to have community police boards, community public safety boards, where professionals are under the command and control of elected public safety commissioners. So that's what we have to do. We have to abolish this appointed police chief hierarchical semi-military structure that the police presently have. And of course, that means we have to come face to face with the police unions and how the police unions have completely outstripped and outstepped the boundaries of their charters and their purpose. We have police unions that right now can determine policies that are law enforcement policies in the black community, whereas the black community have no say-so in these policies at all. So we have to understand what the police unions are, who they represent, what they represent, and why do they have so much political influence to the point where our elected officials are more responsible to them than to us. So we have to first of all take on the political power of the police unions to interfere in the socio-cultural on norms and municipal laws that affect our daily lives and our quality of life. And so community control of police, of course, means that we have to abolish the type of military corporate hierarchy that the police now function under and demilitarize them and make them more accountable to the public and public safety.
I read recently and I heard you speak extensively about stealth history or revisionism. Talk in depth to us about stealth history of revisionism and what it means to you.
Well, stealth history is the rewriting of historical events in a way that a generation would assume that those events substantiate certain types of behavior today. Let me give you an example. People often talk about the Black Panther Party and the original Black Panther Party and what it meant, what it advocated, the types of programs and projects that that party took undertake. But what a lot of folks don't understand is that all during the existence of the Black Panther Party, and the Black Panther Party in its revolutionary and its revolutionary nationalist form only existed for a period of 3 or 4 years. It didn't exist longer than that. You know, people don't understand that at each point, at each year in the existence of the party, that the government unmasked different types of tactics and strategies and stratagems to destroy and derail the party. And one of the foremost ones that they used was, of course, disinformation. They would misrepresent the breakfast programs, instance, as indoctrination programs that was designed to indoctrinate young kids into so that they would hate white. You know, this is the type of stuff that they would have. They conducted hearings. They conducted congressional hearings in which snitches and informers, police informers came and testified in front of Congress that the Black Panther Party breakfast program was a propaganda tool of communists and Black nationalists who hated white people, and that we were indoctrinating the children, and we weren't just feeding them breakfast. It's the same thing that they did with all of those programs. Now, you've had individuals who would go back and look at this history, and the only thing that they would read is a congressional hearing that accuses the breakfast program of indoctrination. And they would use that in their thesis, and they would use that to show how the Black Panther Party's breakfast program really wasn't about breakfast at all. It was about brainwashing Black children. And that's how the history would be portrayed. You see, we don't understand that the word history means his story. And those folks who suppressed the party, who carried out the counterintelligence program, they're the ones that wrote the history that we're reading today. The real radical history, the real Black radical history of the 60s and the 70s has never really been written except in piecemeal form. And so individuals can come out and say, yeah, well, I was in the party in 1968, and they could write their memoirs, and it could be a bunch of crap. It could be a bunch of fabrications and lies. And the press knows that. The different major press know that. And they would give this individual a book contract, and the book will come out, and it'll be a bestseller, or it'll be on the book list, and people would read it, and students would research it. And so the lies get perpetuated. You know, and at the time that the people who actually live through these things are dying off and dying from old age, and of course they don't have any books to be published because they don't have any access to the media. So you know, stealth history is the revision and the rewriting of history by stealth, by changing a few facts here, by lying about representatives, like people, for instance. They make certain assumptions about people we see today and what they actually did back in the 60s, whether it's Karanga, whether it's Angela Davis, whether it's Bobby Seale or anybody. People will make certain assumptions based on what they've read about them, that these are the things that they stood for and this is what they've done. And therefore, you know, they might even name their children after them because they admire those things. But the fact of the matter is that if you look at the histories of these individuals, if you actually know what actually happened, or if there was accounts that reflected what actually happened, you might have a whole different view about some of this stuff or the individuals involved. And so stealth history is a historical revision of the radical tradition to make black radicalism a simplistic, to make it appear as if it failed, appear as if it was idealistic, and reinforce the type of opportunism and black pragmatism that we have today amongst certain organizations and individuals.
All right, as someone that been in the Black Panther Party and was there from day one, and you mentioned the rewriting of history, a lot of people believe that Angela Davis doesn't tell the true story of the Black Panther Party and that she played a small and minute role. What are your thoughts on Angela Davis, her participation in the Black Panther Party, and the political line that she totes today?
I haven't heard anything really where Angela actually said, you know, that she was a member of the Black Panther Party. And I think a lot of folks assume that her relationship to George Jackson and to Jonathan Jackson and to the political prisoners on the West Coast translates into her having been a member of the Black Panther Party. Angela Davis was never in the party. Angela Davis's roots actually come out of the Communist Party USA. You know, she was a red baby. You know, some of her best friends were children of longtime members of the Communist Party USA. She was a student under Herbert Marcuse when she was in college. Herbert Marcuse was an admittedly a brilliant Marxist-Leninist historian and analyst and philosopher, and she considered herself one of his students, and she was involved in the what they call it the Che Lumumba Club, which was a Communist Party USA third world or black formation in California, and that's how she first began to get involved with political prisoners, particularly with Jonathan and George Jackson. So, you know, she was never a member of the Black Panther Party, so that's a misnomer. That's a mistake. But that's what I mean by how people will go back and read accounts. You know, there was a point in time when, and you could remember this, Raheem, there was a point in time not too long ago when there was a dearth, a scarcity of black women, female sheroes for young black women to relate to, you know, other than the ones that, you know, that's been portrayed throughout history, you know, going back to slavery, whether it was Sojourner Truth or whatever. There was a dearth of black women who were actually in the black power movement and was still on the front lines until Elaine Brown wrote her book, Taste of Power, and Angela came out with some publications, and then of course Asada's bio. So these accounts of strong black women in positions of leadership at a tumultuous time in the history of the black movement in the United States has set off a whole wave of admirers and stealth historians who portray these people, these sisters, in roles that they may or may not have played. Now, as far as Angela's current politics and her current analysis, you know, I got some differences with that. As far as her current positions on things with the Democratic Party, with Hillary Clinton, and her analysis of certain things, you know, I have certain problems with that. But then again, too, that, you know, a lot of those differences could be seen in the early writings of George Jackson when he was critiquing Angela's analysis in his prison letters. I know you read that and you've seen the position that George took and you saw the position that Angela took. So, I mean, you know, the fruit don't fall too far from the tree, and she has evolved along those lines. You know, she has evolved along those lines of neoliberalism and the newfound feminist politics that seem to permeate the movement nowadays. You know, this formless disorganization that claims to have intersectional relevancy. you know, which has led to no concrete fronts, no concrete formations that can challenge the status quo in terms of building and prepping our people for a protracted struggle and for protracted violent struggle at that.
Now, when you speak of a protracted violent struggle, some people may argue for that. Some people may argue against that. In 2017, do you think that there is a possibility of a protracted struggle happening in order for individuals or black people in particular to become free?
Well, I don't think black folks really fully understand what they're up against. First of all, we don't understand that we're living in a society that in a nation state that is part, that is the centerpiece of an empire, and this empire is in crisis, and this empire is being chipped away and being chiseled into domestic and foreign policy crises, and these crises are going to affect us, whether it's in terms of employment opportunities. You know, we're living in the middle of a technological revolution, at the beginning of a technological revolution that's unprecedented in human history. Okay, the Industrial Revolution is over. The corporations and the robber barons that established the economic structures and the economic networks of capitalism, of finance capitalism, that revolution is over. And finance capitalism trying to adjust to the macroeconomics of this Industrial Revolution, the shrinking of communications between different people speaking different languages, the melding, the creation of a global culture, of humanity looking at this world as a whole. You know, these things, you know, globalization in terms of communications at threatens all elites all around the world. Which is, and these elites thrive on war. They thrive on conflict. Without war, capitalist economies can't grow. And if they, and they tell you that a capitalist economy that's stagnant is one that's failing, so they can't produce jobs. So you're dealing with a society in which it takes less people to produce wealth, and the majority of people are therefore consigned to being consumers. And as consumers, they have no power. As consumers, they have no leverage. It's only those who control production and control wealth who have any leverage. And that's increasingly becoming a smaller and smaller minority. And we see that in the electoral process. We see that in terms of what the police are out here to do, why they're militarized, why they are so the way they are, that the police are the armed agents of a state that's controlled by wealth, that's controlled by people with power and wealth and influence. And property, and that's the reality. And the majority of people don't have that power, and they are victimized by that. So inevitably, we're headed towards a conflict. We're in a protracted conflict. We're in a protracted conflict right now, in which people are being terrorized and subjected to dehumanization by the very instruments of power that they created to express themselves and empower themselves. So we're living in a situation with a government, the national security state, the state that looks at the deep state, sees all of the citizens as potential terrorists, as potential criminals, people that have to be watched, that have to be surveilled, that have to be put into DNA databanks and all of this stuff, you see. So yes, we're headed for that type of confrontation. We're already in that type of confrontation, and the rise of right-wing Nazism and fascism and white supremacy, you know, just mirrors the insecurity of the class, the white class, that served as a buffer between the elite rich and those who controlled wealth and the masses of people who created that wealth, which is people of color. And so we see that as the demographics in the United States changes, as it becomes browner and browner, you know, we see that the institutions that were built for white supremacy to sustain white supremacy can no longer function in the old way that they used to function. So they have to be changed. You have to build walls, you know, not so much to keep people out, but to make sure that your ass don't get out and to make sure that certain things don't come in. And you see that the rise of rich billionaires to the outright political control of the institutions that's supposed to regulate this type of stuff should tell you that we are on the cusp of global conflict and domestic conflict and war. And we're ill-prepared for it. Our communities are not organized. We don't have control over local law enforcement. We don't have control over those forces in our community that affect our daily lives. And as Imam Jamil Al-Amin said, what you don't control controls you. And that's where we're at right now. We're at the mercy of the national security state and the police state. And we have not devised apparatus to resist that weakness and that subjugation. And that's where we stand right now. Yes, we are headed toward this type of confrontation and this type of conflict.
All right, I got two more questions and then we're done. Israel and Palestine are considered a settler state. Can you enlighten us what started the ongoing conflict in Israel, between Israel and Palestine, and what is the solution to that ongoing problem over there?
Well, Israel is the European settler state. I mean, everybody knows that. The Israelis, the Europeans who settled it, who took the land from the Palestinians, have been trying to convince the rest of the world that, you know, this is the land that God gave them. People that's currently in Israel, they have no relationship to the ancient Jewish people from that region. They're all from Europe. They're all from the region of the Caucasus Mountains. And they adapted Ashkenazi Judaism only 5 or 6 centuries ago. So the people that are there, they're Europeans. They came, they took the land. Actually, the land, the whole arrangement was made as a result of the World War I and the Balfour Agreement and the British collusion with the with Rothschilds and the various Jewish interests, Zionist interests in Europe that were heavily into financing the British and the French and the U.S. involvement in World War I. As you well know, what's Palestine today, what's the occupied Israel today, fell into a League of Nation mandate at the end of World War I. World War I saw Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, which controlled most of the Levant, which today we call Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, and Jordan. That used to be called the Levant. And for over 400 years, it was under Ottoman rule. It was under Muslim Turkish rule. It was part of the Ottoman Empire, just as the northern coast of Africa were part of the Ottoman Empire. And you know, the whole thing we hear about the Marines and the Barbary pirates and the coast, you know, the so-called Barbary pirates on the Algerian and Libyan coast along that line, they were toll keepers for the Ottoman Empire. They controlled all of the commercial traffic heading out to Gibraltar, heading out into the towards the West, and the West didn't like that at the time. And so, you know, that's a whole different story. But in terms of the European settler state of Israel, the British and the Allies who fought against the German and the Central Powers in World War I imposed a fermented Arab rebellion against the Ottoman Empires, against Turkish rule in what is now the Middle East. And that was successful. It resulted in the carving up of the Ottoman Empire. The Turks were on the side of the Germans and the Central Powers in World War II and in World War I, so they were on the losing side. And in fact, Turkey was occupied by the Allies for a certain period of time. So the Ottoman Empire was carved up, and it was given to certain Arab rulers who agreed that the mineral resources, namely oil, that was underneath the sands of the region, could be supplied to the British and the French and the Europeans in perpetuity if they protected their interests. So the British set up, and the French, they created modern Syria, they created Lebanon, they carved it up and they diced it up, and they created the borders for Lebanon, for Syria, for Jordan. They created Trans Jordan. They created modern Egypt. They created the Saudi kingdoms under King Saud, who fought for the British against the Turks during World War One as a guerrilla fighter. And so the Middle East, as we now know it, was created as a consequence of the Allied victories over Germany and the Central Powers in World War One. And it went on to World War II, where the Italians and the fascists tried to retake Ethiopia, Somalia, and all of this stuff. So what we're seeing today, we know about the Jewish, the genocide that the Germans carried out against Jews and non-Germans, the Roma people, and that created the type of global sentiment that permitted the League of Nations mandate, which was transferred to the United Nations when it was formed. The League of Nations mandate, which was up in 1947, I believe, the League of Nations mandate allowed for refugees from war-torn Europe, mainly Jews, to resettle in Palestine, and so that's what they did. They bum-rushed the land. After the end of World War II, they created the state. The first person to recognize that state was the United States, and the rest is history. They fought a few wars with Egypt and its Arab and the Arab neighbors, and they prevailed in all of those wars. And they seized the Golan Heights, and I think the 67 war, they seized the Golan Heights in Syria. They seized Jerusalem and the West Bank in the 67 war, and they have been occupying these territories ever since. And they have been expanding the settlements of Europeans and Americans. We need to understand some of the foremost settlers, the most militant settlers, are white Americans, are white American Jews, who have moved to Israel, who are given a large grants of money to resettle, to move from the U.S. to Israel. So we need to understand that there's a direct correlation between the European settler state of Israel and the United States, just as there was a similar correlation between the apartheid state of South Africa, the Boers in South Africa, and the Dutch and British colonials before South Africa became independent.
I definitely agree with you when you say that there's a correlation between the settler state of Israel and the United States, because a lot of police from the New York City Police Department, if I'm correct, are training them over there, correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the reverse.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
It's actually the Israeli, the Shin Bet, the Israeli version of the FBI. I mean, the New York City Police Department has an office, has a liaison office in Tel Aviv, and you can walk in there, and it got a big NYPD sign on it. I mean, since when did a municipal police department have a liaison office like it was a foreign office of the State Department? So there's a close relationship between Israeli police and U.S. police. If you recall the recent so-called wave of Semitic bomb threats that was threatening, that they said that has risen up during the Trump administration, and it was being talked about more than actual murder of black kids. You know, the so-called rise of anti-Semitism, come to find out it was the Israeli dual citizen who was conducting these bomb threats from Israel, you know, and he was arrested, and, you know, his case is still pending. Now they say that he was mentally defective, he was sick, he was crazy, and all of these things. But we need to understand that American law enforcement and Israeli civil police and intelligence have always worked very closely hand in hand, especially in New York and Chicago and Philadelphia. These police departments have undergone training with the Israelis, and they was doing this back in the days of the Black Panther Party, you know, so this is nothing new. And in fact, if you notice, almost every mayor of New York has to take an obligatory Hajj visit or trip to Israel to show how he is pro-Zionist, how he is a pro-Israel, Israeli supporter. You know, especially when that human rights report came out on Israel and how Israel was violating human rights, and it was a possibly war criminal. You know, Bloomberg jumped on a plane and flew to Israel to show his solidarity with Israel, and how the report was bogus. You see, so we need to understand that, you know, places like New York, where Wall Street is at, have always enjoyed a close relationship to finance capitals, big partners in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
All right, this is Necessary Blackness Podcast, and I'm your host, Raheem Shabazz, and that's going to wrap it up for us with Daruba Ben-Woodhart. Daruba, is there anything that you would like to say in your last closing words, or anything that I forgot to mention that you want to just highlight to our people?
Well, I just want to say that right now, as we speak, over 10 million Africans are on the verge of famine and starvation in Africa. And the only person that recognized this and did something about it, Colin Kaepernick, who sent over a plane load of food to feed starving Africans. Now we have all of these Negroes out there just running around with their gold chains and all of the money and jumping in and out of their limos, talking about how they get paid and how rich they are. You know, so but we don't have a Pan-African Refugee and Relief Agency. We don't have no consortium of black activists who are able to deliver food and shelter and clothing and something concrete to Africans other than rhetoric, other than, you know, buy black and all of that stuff. So that's one of the things I think that we need to understand, that while we're talking about a lot of these things with Trump and AFRICOM and what's going on, we need to understand that there are people, women and children and babies right now, African children and babies, who are starving and on the verge of starvation. So I just wanted that to be a reminder. That's what I'm working on, trying to create a Pan-African Refugee and Relief Agency that's sustained by us and administered by us. We don't have to depend on the Salvation Army or Red Cross in order to deal with African people who are suffering.
Most definitely, because we know when we depend on the Red Cross and different relief agencies that the refugees never get this money. And we've seen that in Haiti, and we've seen that in various states throughout the diaspora. And mm-hmm. we've seen what the Clintons did with the money that was supposed to be allotted to Haiti. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, you know, that's a whole nother program. But what I'm just trying to say is that, you know, I know there are a few activists having worked in Africa with, you know, dealing with Liberian refugees and stuff like that, that we have some young brothers and sisters who have the skill set where we could run our own agency. What we don't have are the resources, and what we don't have is the willpower and to do it. But we can do that. We can provide relief to Africans who are in desperate need of food and shelter and medical care. You know, we can do that. We could partner with the United Nations. We could partner with other private relief agencies. But we have to bring something to the table. And that's what I'm going to try to work on in the next few months. I'm going back to Africa in June and to reestablish my NGO and try to work on that.
A lot of people don't know that at one time you actually lived in Africa for several years. How many years you lived in Africa, and what was your experience like over there?
Well, that's another program. I lived in Africa for about 13, 14 years, and when after I got out of prison, and the experience was it's given me a greater appreciation of the potential of really building a Pan-African movement, but at the same time, I understand how there's an enormous vacuum in Africa in terms of the type of leadership that Kwame Nkrumah, Julius and Nyerere and Sekou Touré once represented, you know. And so now you have Africa is in a crisis. You know, it's in a serious crisis, and just like we're in a crisis over here. It's all related, and so we really have to understand that during this crisis, real wealth is not a dollar bill. That represents debt. You know, a dollar bill, a $10 bill, represents a debt. It's not a representation of wealth. You know, they print that. There's an agency in the U.S. that's not even part of the U.S. government, the U.S. Mint. They print money. They print money on demand. You know, it has no relationship to actual gold or silver or land. It has no relationship to anything. It's printed. And so it's an IOU. It used to be based on gold. It's not based on gold anymore. So what we need to understand, that true wealth, true power, is based on two things right now that are in dire need, and that's land and gold. And Africa got plenty of both. And what we haven't done is we haven't taken the transitory wealth and money and resources that we have and put them into the type of agencies and the type of networks that will empower us, that will allow us to make independent political decisions, that will allow us to run our own independent candidates, that will allow us to be truly sovereign thinking people. And that relationship is a Pan-African, international relationship. The largest diaspora in the world is the African diaspora, and we need to understand what that really means.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to close this out and conclude it. I know I said that before, but this brother has so much knowledge, so much wisdom that he is bringing forth to us. And Daruba, we got to get that book out, brother.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it this year, man. I'm working on it with some comrades, man. We're getting ready to come out with an anthology on Black Liberation Army, you know, written by the soldiers that was in it. So, you know, those of us who are left alive. So we're working on it, man. Appreciate the opportunity to kick it with you on your podcast, man. I really appreciate it.
That's it for us right here on Necessary Blackness Podcast. And I'm your host, Raheem Shabazz. Make sure, family, that you leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to iTunes and put Necessary Blackness in the search engine and leave us a review. Let us know what you think about our podcast. And let us know if you have any ideas for any guests. Also, we received several emails next week. I promise you, family, I'm going to read about 3 or 4 of them online. Continue to send us emails at necessaryblacknesspodcast@gmail.com. And if you don't already have your copy of Elementary Genocide, The School to Prison Pipeline, or Elementary Genocide 2, The Board of Education versus the Board of Incarceration, make sure you go out and get that, family. You can go to ElementaryGenocide.com, get you a copy. You will also go to Amazon and order you a copy. You also can go to Amazon and stream it. For those that like to stream, definitely check out Amazon, stream it on there. And I will see you next week, same time, same place. Peace and Black Power, family.